You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, today is a ceremonial day in a sense when it comes to California's water supply forecast. Department of Water Resources is conducting its April manual snow survey along Highway 50 in El Dorado County just before Echo Summit. This is in addition to more than 100 electronic readings done throughout the state's Sierra Nevada. But the April snow survey, historically, is the best predictor of California's water supply. And this year is reminding us of record-setting years in the past. From the southern to central and northern Sierra, the snowpack varies, but overall is looking to be well above average. And that has great implications for water supply during the warmer, drier months, but that also brings the challenge of striking a cautionary balance for flood control. Jeffrey Mount is a senior fellow in water policy at the Public Policy Institute of California, or PPIC for short, and founding director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Jeffrey joins us yet again with a bigger picture of the winter season and the stress tests that this can pose when all that snow melts. Jeffrey, as always, great to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. I'm sorry I'm not sitting in your studio with you.
I know. I always enjoy seeing you in the flesh, but here we are. You know, I was preparing this segment. It was really, really difficult for me to kind of figure out how to organize our conversation. Where do we begin?
Well, we begin with an unusual year, okay? I mean, this is sort of, by this time, the first week of April, it's all over but the shouting. And this is when the weather patterns shift and we moved into springtime and then on into summer. Although, you've noticed, you haven't worn a T-shirt yet. We actually have had one of the coldest winter and springs I can remember, and I've been here a very, very long time. But now we turn our eyes to the mountains, where we stuffed enough snowpack we're going to have an embarrassment of riches. I mean, a tremendous amount of water, which is currently up there in the snow. And then we're going to have some real struggles trying to manage it when it comes down.
Given that today is the snow survey, and as I said, April 1st is historically, or the beginning of April, is the best determinant of the water year, but that's also broken up into southern, central, and the northern Sierra. How does this year look different in each region?
Well, I can tell you one thing they have in common. They're all well above average. That's good to know. But the northern Sierras, when you basically from about the Feather River north, Yuba and Feather River North, about a little less than its compatriots to the south. And if you look at a map of where atmospheric rivers went this year, that completely tells the story. And it turns out, of the more than a dozen atmospheric rivers, only a couple of them went and made landfall in the far northern part of the state, which is what really hits the Sacramento River and Feather River watersheds and the Trinity River watersheds. Most of the rest of them plowed into the middle part of the state or even in Southern California, which is why we have an extraordinary snowpack as you head south, culminating in I can't overstate it, an epic all-time record snowpack in the Southern Sierras. I think that's what's going to come out of the snow surveys today. And certainly it's backed up by the existing automated gauge surveys, is that we will see in the headwaters of the Tulare Basin the equivalent of the amount of runoff that they get in over almost 3 years' time, average annual runoff. That's how much is sitting up there in snow, which is really remarkable when you think about it.
Given that, when you say that the northern Sierra didn't receive as much snowpack as, say, you know, the southern portion of the Sierra, is that concerning given that our two largest reservoirs, Shasta and Oroville, benefit from the snowpack in the northern Sierra?
Yeah, so when you and I talked a month ago or whatever it was, there was some hand-wringing about the fact that Shasta was not full and Oroville was doing well but not full, and all of that has changed. There's been plenty of precipitation in those watersheds. Oroville, in fact, they've had to start releasing water to manage their flood control reserve, and Shasta is pretty much full. So that's the benchmark you want is, what does your storage look like? And your storage, we're full. Everything's full. The exception to that will be the Trinity, where it may or may not fill. Though they've gotten a lot of snow lately, the reservoir is pretty low. But otherwise, we're full.
Yeah. We're going to get a more accurate number, I believe, after the snow survey, which they usually do around 11 a.m., 11:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. But this morning, I mean, there's already like a really good indication, as you just really laid out, that we're going to be well above normal. From the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab, they're perched at Donner Summit. They're expecting to be well over 200% of normal. Even DWR on Twitter this morning says that this year we'll have one of the largest snowpacks on record, on par with the top three snowpack years since 1950. What does this wet season, what does it remind you of in years past?
Well, so we can use this, we have something like this in the past that most of your listeners will remember, and that was 1983, and that was an El Nino year, and we had a relentless snowpack build up in that particular year. We also had some pretty relentless spring flooding, particularly in the southern part of the Sierra Nevada, that came with it when all that stuff melted off. So it reminds me personally of 83 a lot. And, of course, I do want to remind you, we were in a La Nina this year, not an El Nino. And that is a reminder of how lousy El Nino and La Nina is as a predictor of what we're going to get.
Given that California has the most variable climate in the country, and you brought up 1983, we can even look at 97 or even 2017 or go back to the 50s, what did the drought years teach us? Because that is an important wedge and buffer in between these record-setting wet years.
Yeah, we do tend to forget about the dry when it's wet, and we forget about the wet when it's dry, and that's what Steinbeck reminded us of. I do want to remind you that when we look at climate change signals in California, the one that stands out, the one that you'll never get complete consensus, but you get as close to consensus as you're going to get, is that this drought intensification that has gone on, particularly the last 20 years, is a climate change signal. Now, whether this year, this very elaborate wet that we're having this year, has a climate change signal, the jury's still out on that. That's going to take some work to determine that. But it is consistent with our suggestions that we're going to have even wilder swings between wet and dry. The difference that happened this year, Vicki, is that we got a good soaking. Our overall precipitation is not all that much. It's not huge. It's just that we got so much snow this year. And the reason is we got lucky. We had just enough cold air support that came out of the Gulf of Alaska to these atmospheric rivers that came plowing into California, that they made prodigious amounts of snow instead of rain. We would be having a very different conversation right now if those had been rainstorms rather than snowstorms.
But it wasn't all good news this year. I mean, there were hazards with this season, from flooding. Many lives were lost, property damage from the Central Coast. Even currently, I mean, the Santa Cruz area, the community of Pajaro, like even on last Thursday, they had a march in that community, which is outside of Watsonville, demanding more assistance from the government. This is a community that is largely low income, home to migrant workers. You joined us, back at the start of these atmospheric rivers, because these emergency notifications, it's kind of difficult now in an age where you don't have, like a TV antenna to get reliable current information. What is this teaching us? Because we had emergency declarations at some point across the majority of counties in the state.
Yeah, so here's my takeaways from this year. And as they say, it is all over but the shouting on the precipitation side, but we're really waiting for that snow to come down. So that's going to be something. What we learned this year, first of all, we haven't finished adding up the damages. I think the damages by the time we're done in the Tulare Basin are going to be quite large. So we're probably going to be close to the $2 billion mark by the time the year is over. So that's a lot of money. But that money means it was the disruptions in people's lives. And that we can never forget that. And the Pajaro example is emblematic of one of our greatest challenges in flood management, not just here in California, but across the country. That is a poor community which cannot come up with the money to pay to fix their levees. They're reliant on the state and federal government to help them out. And this is a big social justice or environmental justice question that keeps coming up. Because the way we calculate who gets levy money and who doesn't get levy money depends on the value of the resources that are being protected. And if you're a poor community, you don't have much. And we're seeing this play out right now in the Tulare Basin. We'll probably see it play out later this spring along the San Joaquin River. And we've seen it elsewhere. But the Pajaro was kind of our example of Sacramento has tremendous assets on its floodplain. So it is worth every dime that the federal government, state government, and Sacramento puts into its levies because it reduces the cost of the damages when they occur. It gets harder for these rural communities. And I will say, we are making progress in that. The federal government now has exemptions for these relatively poor communities like Hamilton up north. But we got a long way to go on this. And I'm afraid that's the message we're probably going to take away from this year, both in the Pajaro and in those small communities that are being affected in the Tulare Basin and San Joaquin.
Yeah, you bring up an important point, because what caused the flooding was a breach of a 74-year-old levee on a section of the Pajaro River, and that impacted roughly 3,000 residents in that community. You also mentioned the San Joaquin Valley, and also that this is kind of a stress test to water infrastructure. We had years of drought, and we haven't had a winter like this in quite a while. There's a network of levees and dams. What areas are you watching more closely than others?
Okay, so for now, I think we're done with the rain floods for the season, but we're now into the snowmelt floods. And I think the news you're going to be looking at for the next few months is really going to be the runoff that occurs into the Tulare Basin and the runoff on the San Joaquin. Both of them have record or near-record snowpacks. Both systems are susceptible to spring snowmelt flooding. So the water cannon is loaded. I mean, it's quite loaded. So I want to say we're ahead of it. I mean, even though there's damages occurring right now, and there's people worried about the level of the San Joaquin River and of course what's going on in the Tulare Basin, the flooding of the reemergence of Tulare Lake, we actually haven't hit anywhere close to the peak. That's not going to happen until the end of May. So, you know, this is a classic stay tuned. This is one of the times where we have a natural disaster that's going to unfold very slowly. And we get a chance to sort of, we know it's coming. There's nothing we can do to stop it. All we can do is prepare for it and plan for recovery when it's over.
You mentioned the Tulare Basin, and we're going to have a longer conversation about this later on in the week. But talk to us briefly about Tulare Lake, because this is kind of like an ephemeral lake of sorts. And this year is kind of a big deal. But you also mentioned in an article that you wrote for PPIC that it's going to be different this time as well, like a wrinkle with two impacts.
Yeah. So first and foremost, to remind your listeners, the Tulare Basin, which is the most fertile farmland we have in California, it's one of the nation's great corn production regions, was historically a lake. And it was a lake. It was the largest water body west of the Mississippi. And basically, in most years, they capture, control, consume all the water that runs into that basin because it has no linkage to the ocean. So it's like all the water just goes into a bowl. Tongue-in-cheek, nature bats last. So nature is becoming reacquainted with the Tulare Lake, and we're going to see a very, very large lake. Here's the problem. The way we manage that lake, the way we manage the infrastructure that we have in place to sort of manage water in that system is going to be overwhelmed. But the wrinkle in all of this is we have been terraforming that part of the world quite aggressively for the last 10 to 15 years through groundwater pumping. So you have a lot of subsidence in that area. In fact, the center of the Tulare Lake has now shifted to the south because there's been so much groundwater pumping and subsidence. So the fact is, we don't know. We just, at this point, don't know what's going to happen. All we know is that water flows downhill. Take the money. It will flow uphill the money. But flows downhill, and it's going to find a low spot in that basin and probably for a couple of years.
And you bring up a good point with the San Joaquin Valley because, you know, even the PPIC, there was another article from your organization in February that, you know, this region produces more than half of the state's agricultural output. It's an important contributor to our country's food supply. And that in terms of revenue, Fresno, Kern and Tulare counties are the nation's top three agricultural counties. However, this article was important because He also forecast by 2040, average annual water supplies could decline by 20%. We're talking about this at a time when we have a winter that's rivaling record-setting years over the decades. So I think there's like a bigger message of California still in a mindset of doing more with less.
You know, and I do want to tell you, that article and articles we've written at PPIC so much over the last few years, it's the bottom line is this. We have to learn to live with less. And in fact, I will remind you, in periods of extraordinary abundance like this, does not make any economic sense to try and capture and control it. It makes sense to do whatever we can to push it into the ground, because we're going to fill all our reservoirs. But we need to put it into the ground. This is going to be a banner year for groundwater recharge. But we could turn right around and have just like we did in remember 2019. You know, we were having conversations about how much water it was and how great it was. By the end of 2020, our reservoirs were in trouble, and by the end of 2021, it was a crisis. So we have to remember all the time that we will go back into this increasingly intense drought conditions very quickly, even when we've had abundance like this. So yes. And the argument we make is that the San Joaquin and Tulare Basin are going to have to learn to live with less in the future. And that means we're probably going to have a smaller footprint of irrigated agriculture. But as we point out in this does not have to have major economic and social impacts. If you do it smart, it's going to be okay.
We also can forget sometimes that water is also required for energy, for hydropower generation, thermoelectric power plants, you know, and even oil and gas extraction.
Right. I mean, water fits in everywhere. And, by the way, you need it for our cities as well. Our economy couldn't exist without it. So, Vicki, water is a target-rich environment. We will always have something to be wringing our hands about, even when we have abundance like this.
In a few months, or maybe hopefully in a few months, I mean, we're going to get a better idea of what the wildfire season is looking like for this year. What concerns you, given that we had such a robust winter?
Okay, so you have been following the chatter about this. There's two schools of thought about this. One is that we're increasing our wildfire risk because our fine fuels, which is what really, really makes these fires go fast, move fast, fine fuels like brush and grass, are doing great. Your backyard is probably completely overgrown right now. There's so much water in this out there today. So that's one approach. They say, you know, we might have a really tough season. And then there's a flip side that points out historically, when we have really wet years like this, we tend not to have the real big screaming fire problems we've had in the past. The bottom line, actually, Vicki, is this on fire. What they really are discovering is it's mid to late season weather conditions drive fire intensity so much. And if we have a hot, dry summer like we did 2 years ago, including lots of wind, we're going to have fires. We'll have big fires, no doubt about it. But like last summer where we didn't have those conditions, we didn't have so much fire. So it's really important to pay attention to the weather conditions during the summer. That's what's going to hit us.
Yeah. I mean, I will always remember how you say the disaster memory half-life of you know, when it's wet, we forget about the times when it's dry. And now we have headlines that temperatures are rising to the 70s this weekend in some areas like Sacramento. And I don't think there's much rain in the forecast, at least in our area. How do you want people to think about this winter as now we're starting to officially feel like we're in spring and the seasons are changing?
Yeah. So I am looking forward to wearing a pair of shorts and a T-shirt because I live in the Sacramento Valley and I expect by this time of year for things to be warm. So we are turning to sort of what I would consider to be normal spring conditions or average spring conditions starting next week. At least that's what it looks like. It still has been remarkably cool. But you're right. It's the disaster memory half-life tends to be very short for everybody. It's not just Californians. It's everybody else. And it's really worthwhile reminding that, you know, we were in a world of hurt just 6 months ago. And we were really panicked, not panicked, too strong a word, but we were really concerned about our water supply just 6 months ago. And that's how quickly things can turn here. And I think that's the newsflash of being in the water world in California is it can go from wonderful to miserable to miserable, completely different direction, so very quickly. And that's, you pointed out in your lead-in, we are the most variable climate, actually, I think in North America. That's hardwired into our thinking, and we should never forget it. Just because it's raining now doesn't mean we won't be wringing our hands in a year from now about not enough water.
Yeah, and researching water for you never gets boring because of that. Jeffrey, thank you so much for the time.
Yes, right. Always something to do.
Yeah. Jeffrey Mount is a senior fellow in water policy at the Public Policy Institute of California, talking about this year's above average snowpack, what it means and what it doesn't mean for California's water needs. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.